Hello? Hello?
Hello?
It's kind of fun. Can I get a hello from the audience? Hello?
Hello. All right. There we go.
We're going to try to do this maybe a little differently. Of course, maybe the same as the last panel. But I'd like to make this a little bit of a dialogue. You know, as one thing you may have noticed is that we're trying to I was just going to show a few videos for no reason at all here. And of course, the Flash player wasn't installed. Partly from a lot of experience and video on the web, I'm not actually sure that it actually works anyways. Wait. I'm being proven wrong right now.
Well, actually.
What? All right. Very nice. But let me ask a couple quick questions just to start off. How many of you out there watch films on your computer? Pretty good. TV shows? Clips, YouTube? Is there anybody who doesn't watch clips on YouTube? Okay. How many of you watch? Oh, there's two. Okay. Yeah, I'm asking the wrong questions. I'll have to reverse it. How many of you watch films on your iPhone or your PSP or iPod? Wait, all three of those. What was that number? Everybody put your hand up. Well, that's interesting. So what are we, about 30, 40%? Interesting. TV shows? What about clips? And podcasts? Ooh, we got a podcast audience. I like that. All right, great. So anyways, I'm going to give just a little bit of intro, and then I'll let all the panelists here have their shot and tell you some of their stories. And they have more than they can tell. The first thing I want to sort of note here is that there's sort of two different topics that we're going to discuss, or maybe partly not discuss. And the first one is sort of theoretically what it means to produce content across the different platforms. And by that, I mean that when you're producing a narrative show or when you're producing documentary content, that it's obviously different than, you know, the standard half hour or 1 hour or 2 hour content that you necessarily see on your 10-foot experience on your TV. It may not be, actually. Because a lot of you are watching movies, which is two-hour content on all these different devices. But essentially, the idea of content distribution across those devices, potential revenue streams, and then maybe even different ways that we're sort of exploring narrative options now that we're watching these things on different devices. The second topic, you know, I tend to think that we're not actually going to talk too much about. I mean, I think we could answer some questions and I'll be part of what we do. But that's sort of more the technical constraints of producing, you know, video content for the web and mobile devices. You know, lots of close-ups. But not necessarily, because all of you are watching movies and nobody's making movies and saying, let's put in some close-ups because they're going to watch that on a telephone. Or at least as far as I know, not. You know, whether it's 16:9 or not, whether there's HD coming, whether you should be optimizing for 750 kilobits or 500 or 300 or whatever that is. If you really have a question, we'll try to answer it for you. But I think in general, we're going to try to stick to sort of the more meta topics on this subject. That's pretty much the way it is for me. I'm going to introduce my panelists now, or have them introduce themselves and give their introductory statements, and we'll go from there. So starting at the end.
All right. I'm Jason. Not to be confused with that Jason over there. I'm the first Jason here. I work for Current TV, our Current Media, and we are we're a media company. We are on television here in the States, in about 40 some million homes. We're also in the UK, and we're launching in Italy soon. And we're also on the web, of course, on current.com. And I oversee a couple of different units within programming or content creation, which is original programming to basically all of the series we have, as well as some of the kind of one-off, what we call pod production or short form pieces. I oversee content acquisitions. So anything we kind of buy from, you know, from, you know, people out there in the world, broadly defined, and also our viewer created content group, or VC Squared, which is you know, our kind of version of user generated content. When we first started doing this, we were out, you know, Al Gore, who's our chairman, and Joel Hyatt, who's our CEO, were out raising money 5 years ago, and you know, came up with this idea of wanting to have, you know, some of our content made by viewers. And everybody thought it was the craziest thing they'd ever heard and laughed them out of the room. But of course, the world's changed pretty fundamentally in that time. We still do focus on a different kind of element of UGC, in the sense that, you know, it's kind of now become all things to all people, in a sense. We still are kind of curated in terms of what we do, what we're looking for in UGC, but we have embraced we embraced UGC, and we're at the vanguard of UGC very early, both in terms, and I think we'll talk about both of these things here, in terms of you know, what kind of formats can be utilized both on TV, on the web, on mobile phones and other devices, as well as you know, how you use technology to create these things, and the emerging technologies that have enabled so many more people to get involved in terms of creating content, and making that all a real possibility to, you know, kind of be, you know, dispersed, not only on a handful of television networks that happen to be based in New York or LA, but, you know, that anybody can kind of have a voice and have that voice be heard. So that's me.
I'm David Todd. I've been working in online video for about 10 years. Started out by promoting bands and animation online. Moved various places, mp3.com, mp4.com, MSN Music. Did a user-generated type pilot for television a couple of years too early. And most recently, I've been at iSpot.com, which is an online video remixing platform and website. And I don't actually work there anymore as of a couple of weeks ago, but I did work there for the last 2 years. And what we did was allowed people to interact with, quote, premium content. So music from independent and major record labels, movies, movie studios. And it was an interesting journey, because when we thought about it, when we started iSpot, we thought it would be this very creative sort of playground, or a petri dish, if you will, where, you know, all this creativity would come out of it. And there was a lot of creative stuff that came out of it, but it became more of a useful marketing arm for labels and studios, because those were the most successful things. People weren't actually as creative just without a prompt. Like, if you wanted them connect directly with the latest single from a band, those people were really passionate about it. But if you just said, make something, we didn't actually see a lot of that. So that's me.
And I'm Jason, number two. I have kind of a long and crazy checkered past with both media and interactive. What feels like a million years ago, I worked on some of the finest straight-to-video horror films ever produced, like Necronomicon, Return of the Living Dead 3, as a property master and a lead man and all kinds of stuff. And then I went to San Francisco and I became a broadcast designer, and I was recruited by a gigantic internet consultancy, which no longer exists, called IXL, to form a group, because back then in Bubble 1.0, everybody thought, hey, the web's going to look like TV soon, so we should get some of these broadcast designers. And I was brought in, and we actually did this really fun and kind of innovative project where we put a full episode TV network on the internet, and it lasted about a month and a half, and then it died, and then IXL went down in flames. And from there, I was recruited to join the whole group that I was part of, was recruited to join BBC Consulting, or starting a consulting group within the BBC. And we did a lot of work for various broadcasters, ESPN, CNN, a lot of the Turner properties. In this case, it was kind of, rather than the customer's view, it was the behind the scenes stuff. So the you know, the stuff that the producers and the journalists and the editors would use, you know, the asset management systems, et cetera. And through various twists and turns, I'm now before you today. I've got a day job where I'm a user experience architect for Adobe Systems. But really, I think the reason why I'm sitting here is because I'm the lead writer for an interactive internet soap opera called PodOperaBrooklyn.com. And it's kind of an experiment in terms of taking user-generated content into a different realm, user-generated stories. And so the idea is it's kind of a collaboration. I'm interested in this collaboration between the storyteller and the audience, and allowing the audience to kind of drive what happens next in the stories. And so basically that's, I think that's why I'm sitting up here. And it's a little terrifying to see 300 people staring back at me, or however many people are sitting in the room. But it's good to see you guys too. And hopefully we'll have a fun dialogue here today.
You all look like zombies with green badges.
It was better than last year, where I had the first panel on Sunday morning after the time change at South by Southwest. It was a great time to have a panel, let me tell you. So.
Well, just because they got to introduce themselves, I'm going to introduce myself. So I'm Hank Blumenthal, and I actually started and still continue to work in the motion picture business, mostly as a producer and also as a director. I did about 15 films before I decided to sort of move into digital media. I worked at places like Sputnik 7, 24/7, film, music, anime all the time. Does anybody remember it? Thank you so much. That's very kind of you. Did the first day and date release of Blood, The Last Vampire, an anime movie with manga, stuff like that. But like you say, not that many people remember it. You know, back then it was, I'm not going to count the years, maybe seven, eight years ago. And Real Player 8 was the solution to all of our streaming video needs forever. Real DVD quality, no problems with stuttering, et cetera. Flash Video now, of course, works perfectly. Nobody ever has any problems. No low bandwidth connections out there, I'm sure. I've been working with a company called Schematic, doing a lot of prototyping, but also building a lot of interactive television platforms. In particular, I've worked on the MCE platform, Media Center, for Microsoft, which is one of their ways of creating an IPTV service. We're basically up and running right now for anybody who has Vista. who has Vista out there?
Show of hands.
Well, that's another test there. But in any case, if you have Vista, you have Media Center, and you can get quite a number of channels from National Geographic to MTV, VH1. I actually did MTV, VH1, MTVU, where we created interactive TV programming to be watched on your computer, but also to be wirelessly sent around your house to your Xbox 360 and to Media Center devices theoretically connected to your big screen TVs. That's where I come from. So now, I think, because these guys haven't been totally forthcoming, I'm going to sort of ask them a few questions. I'm going to start with David, who apparently had a sordid journey throughout some of the third world countries and discovered some sordid things about web and mobile devices and watching.
It wasn't sorted at all. I was with my wife. But I just got back from Vietnam and Cambodia, which was an amazing 3 weeks. And I wish I'd had 3 months to do it instead. And, you know, working in music and video and film and online stuff for the last, well, long time, because I was doing music for 10 years before, I'd always known about, you know, people talking about the threat of piracy and how everybody's going to consume their media differently. And I, you know, I read Fast Company and Paid Content, and I get all my RSS feeds and I know the stats, but it didn't really hit me until there I was in Hanoi a few weeks ago, and my desk clerk is sitting there in the hotel, is sitting there watching movies encoded in Windows Media format all day long from either pirated or from actual download sites there, you know, and they're not watching it on a $2,000 Mac or a, you know, $300 iPod. They're watching it on a $200 Windows PC that is at work. They might not even have a computer at home. But it was, I guess what was really fascinating to me was getting this epiphany that, oh, people really are having a very different introduction to media and consuming media in a very different way than I did and do now. I mean, the other fascinating thing would be being out in some very remote place and having some thousand-year-old woman rowing you down a river, and it seemed very timeless. And she'd whip out her Nokia phone with a 3-inch color screen on it and text somebody at home. So, I don't know. I just found that really interesting. I guess we were talking earlier, you know, is this the future? I kind of think it is. You know, I think we're there.
Jason, how about, since you're in the future with, the Brooklyn Pod Opera, is that right?
Pod Opera Brooklyn.
Maybe you'd like to tell us to like some of the obstacles or the differences or the similarities to other sort of narrative production.
So the way Pod Opera Brooklyn works, it's completely different from, and I write standard narrative as well, but it's a completely different experience because what we do is we write a 5-minute episode and we shoot it and we edit it and we post it to the web. And then basically we ask the audience what they want to have happen next. So we don't actually know. We have no concept of where the plot's going to go. We have no idea of you know, who's going to be required for this particular episode, you know, the next episode, et cetera. So it just means that you constantly have to kind of think on your feet and you have to be very nimble. And in terms of production, you have to be very, very guerrilla-like in the way that you shoot things and very quick and fast in the way that you do everything, which sometimes can be challenging, to say the least. And then another piece of it is that there's this kind of danger of the lowest common denominator, depending on how big your audience is. If you say, hey, do you want to see the two women make out? Or do you want to see, you know, somebody, you know, rob a bank? Or do you, I mean, everyone's always going to go to the kind of lowest common denominator. So what we found early on was that we had to ask questions in the right way so that it didn't just turn into some kind of porn fest, basically.
When you say in the right way, I have two questions.
Sure.
One, how democratic is the process? Is it a voting thing or is it just really?
Yeah,
so they vote. Okay.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, what's your turnaround time from when you look at their responses to when you produce another?
Well, when we were cooking, right now we're sort of on hiatus, which is kind of a problem because we're working on another project, another panel. If you guys are interested, I'll tell you about it later. We would turn episodes around once every 2.5 weeks.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of an issue. I mean, that was another thing. There's a little bit of an issue in terms of, you know, frequency is something, if you're doing a podcast type thing, you want to have kind of a frequency of delivery of content so that people are, you know, constantly checking back in so that they remember what the storyline is, et cetera. That was definitely another barrier. I think, you know, as we kind of rethink how we approach production, I think we might, we also have a huge cast, and I mean, I think we might end up kind of simplifying a little bit and doing a little bit more, you know, shooting within maybe one location rather than, I mean, we went all over Brooklyn. You know, we're shooting outside, we're shooting in people's apartments, et cetera. So it was a little bit of a challenge there. But
so people had to come back in 2 weeks. And so
yep.
That in that way, you know, it's a model that they're used to of they grew up with watching TV, you know, every week or every whatever it
was.
Yep. So it's kind of a hybrid, really.
Yeah.
It depends on how you define narrative and what is narrative. I mean, we you know, we wrestled with this a lot in terms of what we were doing on TV and online, because those are, you know, two media that we straddle. You know, and you know, we were just recently talking about a project we're launching, and there's a linear video component to it, and it's a linear video component. It's something you would see on TV. It's something we're in fact going to put on TV. But that doesn't necessarily make for compelling narrative or the same sort of thing we'd put online, because online you have much different ways of being able to interact. So in certain cases, if we're syndicating this product to YouTube as an example, which is a video site, we will show the same product in a linear fashion we do on TV. But if we are showing it, if we're allowing people to embed it on their Facebook page or, you know, or somewhere else, then, you know, there was a big question as to, well, why is this experience going to be different than just showing a video that you could otherwise see on TV. And one of the key components of that is the idea that you can interact and it can be a dialogue. And so, you know, it's not only about the item that you put forth, but how people then in effect change that. And it's kind of, you know, mixing in a different way in terms of, you know, what the whole is greater than the sum of the parts in a sense.
How is it a dialogue when you put it online that way?
Well, I mean, I can talk to specifically what we're doing, but the idea is, I mean, what current.com has evolved into from what it was before. Before, you know, we really 3 years ago launched it as a way for us to be able to able to upload videos to potentially get on TV, which at the time was a novel concept. You know, but it wasn't really a consumer facing proposition. Yes, you could come and watch videos at our site and that was all well and good, but fundamentally it was geared towards the producer community and people who wanted to have their voices heard and not, you know, and you didn't have to be one of, you know, one of a couple hundred development executives at a television network to get your voice heard. You know, what, you know, as the world has evolved, you know, what we relaunched at the end of last year was really reflecting what we were trying to do with Current On Air, which is redefine news and information for our 18 to 34 demographic, but do it online in a way that was unique to online. So, you know, the idea with Current.com right now is you can essentially, clip anything from the web anywhere, and it goes back to the source. But basically, it allows you to start a dialogue around that item, whatever it is. It could be a video, it could be embedded video, it could be something that takes you back to another site. It could be a, you know, it could be anything. But then it's not only about that piece of media that you are clipping to that will link somewhere else. It's also about the dialogue around that item itself, which is what is interesting and why it's a different narrative.
When you say clip, meaning you can embed that URL or what?
Yeah, you can do it in different ways. It depends, obviously, where you're going, where you're getting it from. If it's something, a New York Times story, it's a link back to the New York Times. If it's a YouTube video that you can embed, then you can embed the YouTube video. So it just depends on what it is. But I mean, the idea is it's a way to, you know, kind of highlight things that you know, our audience might want to tell others about in the same way that, you know, for instance, Dig does, but it allows you to have a dialogue around those issues, you know, so if it's something about, you know, Benazir Bhutto getting assassinated or Radiohead releasing its album online or whatever it is, you know, you can then have a discussion about it within the community. So
when you say within the community, do you mean but in the comment area underneath it?
That's correct.
Because I'm always fascinated by, you know, how do you spark conversations. And you were talking about what becomes a conversation. I worked on a project for almost a year that just launched now for South by Southwest with ITVS, which is a PBS affiliated production company that produces, I'm going to confuse POV and Independent Lens.
Yeah.
They produce Independent Lens. And we did this thing called Filmocracy, which allowed people to take some clips from actual films, from the films themselves, and some prompts or an idea that you would answer questions or engage with the basic ideas in the film.
This was a mashup, right?
And make a mashup using the online video mashup tool. And that just launched. It's at iSpot, and it's also at itvs.com. But one of the interesting things about it is we wanted to go beyond just yet another make a mashup contest because there have been, I don't know, 1,000 in the last 2 years I've been doing this stuff. So what was cool about this is they had the filmmakers of King Korn and some other pretty cool documentaries give various filmmaker tips, like video, you know, direct to, you know, how would you do some stop motion animation or, you know, how do you, so it was sort of a combination of like tutorials and engagement. And ideally, I would like to see that go further to where you have, whether it's, you know, weekly chat sessions or something, but you really allow people access to the media makers who are interesting to them. And hopefully somebody, you know, everybody gets something out of that. So, yeah, check it out. Filmocracy.
Jason, maybe you want to sort of talk about how yours is sort of an interactive, I mean, you began the sort of conversation, so I'm curious,
sure.
Can you reflect on what they said?
Well, actually, it makes me, I mean, this may be not even, this is totally off the point, but what I find really interesting about everything that we're saying here is that, you know, there's a difference between creating content for, you know, sitting in front on your couch and watching a television set and creating content with or a device where you actually have some capability of doing something to it or doing something while you're watching mm-hmm. it. And that being said, I think it's really fascinating, though, that everybody goes and watches Lost on the ABC Fall episode player because there's no interaction there at all except sitting, you know, except on demand. I want to watch it when I want to watch it or, right. you know, downloading it and watching it on their iPod. So there's got to be other elements about, you know, creating content for the web and creating content for devices that have to do with, you know, mobility, and I want to watch this while I'm on the subway, or I want to watch this and it's not playing on ABC and I don't want to mess with my DVR or whatever. But this whole thing about interactivity, what I find really interesting from the standpoint of Pod Opera Brooklyn is that we use the soap opera model. And the reason why we use the soap opera model is because there's a long history in the soap opera of the audience communicating to the creator, communicating to the storytellers and changing the story of the soap opera. It goes all the way back to kind of Victorian England. And they would have these potboiler pulp magazines where you would have these serialized stories that would come out.
Right.
And so the first episode would come out and everyone would write back in and they would say, you know, we want to see, you know, Colonel Mustard Bottom, you know, marry Princess Thistle Whistle or whatever. And then the next episode would be written based on, you know, all of this interact, you know, all these letters from all these viewers. And I think that what the internet allows us to do is to take that, like, you know, 1,000 steps further and do it, you know, 1,000,000 times faster. Is that a good thing? I'm still not 100% sure, but I think it's worth playing with and experimenting with. And it's something that, boy, I tell you, in terms of, as a writer, it was really exciting and really challenging to wake up in the morning and then have to write an episode that incorporated, a choice that maybe I hadn't even thought about. You know, it's the constraints, I think, that make for, I think by constraining your creative process, you can really, you know, push yourself to go beyond your kind of standard way of approaching things. Anyway, and I'm kind of babbling.
So one more thing about that, as far as the dialogue, like I'm not sure, I don't know how much mobile video stuff Current did, but iSpot did a lot, you know, send clips to your phone. The initial Filmocracy project had also, you could send clips to a mobile phone, and this is before the iPhone, and you could rate things, etc. I know you guys have done some things with mobile.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious what the participation rate has been compared to straight to the web or something like that.
We haven't actually done a lot of mobile stuff. And actually, this brings up another point, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point, which is the revenue model. And the fact of the matter is, you know, obviously we want to be everywhere that our audience is, but at the same time, we're a business and we want to make sure that we are, you know, figuring out how to do something that's sustainable over the long term. And, you know, it's true both, I think, to some degree on the web and on mobile phones. Nobody's quite figured out exactly what the model is yet. So we've had lots of opportunities to do things on mobile, but the question has always been, well, how and why is there an audience, and also is this sustainable for us? I mean, we could do this, but what, you know, we have to figure out why we're doing it. Is it purely a creative decision? Is it a marketing decision? Is it a, you know, is it a business decision? So we've certainly, you know, worked to some degree with online, but more so we've really looked to develop, you know, the two screen first, and then, you know, we are experimenting with the third screen, but figuring out exactly what that's going to mean as that market kind of evolves.
So, and there's one thing we haven't addressed, because I guess none of us actually work in this, but that I'm kind of interested in, is the whole live casting phenomenon, right? Started with Justin TV, Justin.tv. Certainly Ustream is doing really well. Yahoo has announced, and for those of you who don't know, it just means, you know, you get to broadcast and stream your world live, right? And so everybody gets their own show, which was sort of the promise of this whole democratization of media from the beginning. And
two okay movies.
What's that?
Well, there was two movies that were also broadcast your life, weren't there?
Thank you very much.
It's that plate in your head, man. It's like,
yeah, when I came back in the States. I don't know. I'd be curious about what you guys want to talk about.
Well, I see people already, they're jumping with their hands already. It's just crazy. I just want to add like one little bit of like finesse, because I see on one end of the table quite a bit of dialogue, which I think is extremely interesting. And over here, sort of interactivity with narrative with the audience. Whereas I actually think with a lot of the work that I've been doing, what my real focus is watching the way that you take, for example, on Nickelodeon, 100 clips of SpongeBob, and you chop that into short clips, and then you allow people to interface with those clips, not in the standard show by show narrative linear format. And as we evolve to being able to sort of pick and sort through our narratives, it doesn't sort of relieve us of the needs to create sort of a whole narrative. But it starts to begin to really change it. So I'm sort of less interested in how the audience, contributes to the narrative that's being presented to them and how they actually read the narrative itself. But since people are sort of chomping at the bit, I'd actually just like to open it up, not necessarily for questions or you can append one, but really for opinions. What do people think? Are they really craving? How many people really want to have a dialogue with their video? How many embed their videos? Okay. How many have suggested a plot twist?
A plot twist. Two, three.
How many consume bits of TV shows, but randomly?
Well, anybody with a remote, right?
10 foot. Okay. Anybody have a comment? You're straight back.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. And I think that I'm fascinated by that world, and particularly things like incredibly high quality Star Trek episodes that are out there on the web that look
Marshall.
Like the real thing, that are they're amazing.
Right.
What we were trying to do was to kind of give our audience because we shot this in a very kind of professional, high quality way and edited it in a very professional, high quality way. We were trying to give them that kind of experience a little bit. And the idea was I think we were taking a step towards that world where, hey, you want to see Harry Potter make out with Hermione or whatever, but you're right. I mean, we didn't quite get to the point where the audience would have complete control over the narrative. And I think that's kind of a little bit why we're on hiatus now, trying to figure out what the next step is.
And so with iSpot, we tried to give them, so we were doing two things. One was, first of all, we said, you can do whatever you want with this content. Then we started realizing that most people are intimidated by a finished piece of content, and they don't want to take a $250,000 trailer that's been edited for weeks in a post house in LA, and they're not going to necessarily do something, quote, better. But if you cut it up into little puzzle pieces or loops or whatever it is, they can engage with it and play with it. And people were more likely to do that. And so, to your point, the people who do fan fiction are often at sort of a higher level. And we were trying to be the gateway drug or the entry, the entry drug for quote creativity, letting people be involved with this stuff that they were already engaged in.
And I think one other point is, you have to remember what all this technology has done, whether it's the technology that allows you to produce or the technology that allows you to distribute, is it allows more voices to have a chance to tell a story. That doesn't mean that all those stories are going to be good. Yep. In fact, most of them are not good. But before, you had a situation where only very few people could tell those stories because you had to know somebody to get it done, and it was very expensive to do. Now anybody can do anything, but you know, 99.9% of it is still fairly shitty. So it's like but the good thing is that, I mean, the interesting thing is now voices that there are some really genuinely interesting voices that do emerge just because of the mask you're talking about, that never would have been heard of before. And it also allows, you know, again, to some of the things we've talked about, it allows people that don't think inside the box a certain way about how content should be produced to do things that nobody would have thought of before. And it ends up being really interesting and new and kind of drives things in different directions.
Well, and I actually think there's, I definitely agree that 99% of almost any, creative enterprise is not worth watching. But I think that almost all of it is worth doing. And yep. I think that, you know, you allow people to be engaged and play with stuff. Because really, you know, 20 years ago or something, I wouldn't have thought that I could be involved with the Shins or some band that I loved or whatever. And now, you know, I have that connection and I'm allowed to do it and I get something out of doing that. And even if only two or three people watch it, I got to do it. You know, if we, the marketer people, are lucky, hundreds of thousands or millions of people watch it, but really that shouldn't be the only goal.
Somebody was really raising their hand.
There's a guy standing up here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Well, you guys are,
he's very patient.
You know, you were.
Go back three speakings. And sorry. You're speaking my thoughts, exactly, which was.
The
big evolution, the big change, the thing everybody was looking for, you know, was if you've got a camera, you can go out and you can make anything. You can do it. Anybody can do it. So that's gone. That's over. It used to be you have to have money, you have to have this. Now you got a camera, you got a computer, you can produce anything. Now you said 99% of it is crap. And you actually have to
wait. Yeah, but the 1% sells to Sony for $500,000.
Yes, absolutely.
Or CBS for $4 million.
You know, but what's amazingly popular? What's really, really working? Are we trying to innovate in terms of what sounds like a good idea? Are we innovating based on things that we know that are engaging, and how do we really tie into what is engaging? I mean, look at what's happening now with like the truth shows on TV and the American Idol and stuff like that. What is it about the engagement, the voting? You know, is it the voting? Is it the talking about? Because it's not really, like you said, it's not really about the people want to jump on and create with you. It's that everybody wants to have their say on what happened, whether they agree with it or they don't. So where is that engagement? Where is that how do you get the buy-in? Because that's really where your revenue is going to come from. It's where everybody's, if you're going to create a show, you're really only going to be able to have a show if you have a following. So what's working and how do we capitalize on what's working to create better content?
What do you think? What do you want?
I want it fresh.
Fresh is good.
I want it. It's like sushi. It can't taste fishy. But at the same time, I love a good queso. I love a good Velveeta. You know what I'm saying? So you've got to have that thing between what's fresh, what's tasty, what's expensive, what's alluring. At the same time, what is easily digestible when I don't want to think? What do I want? You know, personally, I'm passionate about it because I've invested my entire life in it.
Your name?
My name is Michael Weiss.
And what do you do?
I'm president of Confidence Bay Incorporated, confidencebay.com. We've built a mobile high definition editing suite out of an RV. So we go across the country when somebody wants to create something, boom, and we're editing it there. And we're hooked up to a satellite truck and we're pumping it out there. But we're working with MSN Video, we're working with AT&T, and you'll see people spending gobs and gobs of money, but they didn't do the marketing or they didn't think it through. And you have 100 people spending a lot of money making content. And like you said, 1% of it. It's fantastic. 99% of it, we have hundreds. It's crickets, and nobody's online watching.
Well, maybe 10% is fantastic, and 1% gets distributed.
All right.
I think there's actually two interesting points there. One is that we keep thinking about people like they're just one big mass, and that they all want the same thing, right? Yeah. And like, so interactive is, I mean, like being interactive with your media is one thing, and when you're talking about a news story and you want to debate whether, you know, it's Hillary or Obama or, you know, or the other side, or if you just want to watch an episode of Lost, you want to sit there and watch an episode of Lost. Those are two totally different like needs that are being met by that media, right?
And you're saying what you want. I mean, what you want is like, you know, I mean, different people want different things. So it's right. Like, as I was going to say, it's like watching an episode a lot. There's a reason why people like to watch television shows that are popular because they're well-presented stories. There's an opportunity to be able to interact with things. There's a reason why, you know, Lonely Girl became popular. Yep. I mean, there are different reasons and there's different hooks. There's not one hook that's like, this is what it is and this is what's going to make it successful. But the interesting is almost none of those things existed in the past except yep. for watching television shows that were linear that were made by, you know, some people in LA, New York. So that's why it's interesting.
And then I think, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think the other theme that is that this, you know, the sea of crap that where there's like diamonds floating in it. I think, you know, there's a big theme there in Web 2.0, whatever you want to call it, like the people like Current are doing, which is, you know, curating content and pulling out the gems. And then there's the other side of that, which is the digs of the world, which are, you know, where you look to the community to tell you what the good stuff is, right?
And hopefully that can lead to, you know, what another holy grail has been that I might think it's crap and you might think it's a diamond. Exactly. And that there will be enough systems in place and people are trying to do it that, you know, you can aggregate enough of a viewership across the world, you know, and there's a way to make it economically feasible, whether it's, you know, through the blog ads or whatever it is, you know, that people can decide for themselves what they like.
Have you seen the 1,000 true fans?
No.
Okay. So that's this idea that any creator, if you have 1,000 true fans, and these are defined as people that are willing to pay, mm-hmm. right? It's a long tail thing.
Yeah.
That if they're willing to pay a day's worth of their salary for you, you can survive as a creator, right? Yeah. So that's something that the internet actually enables.
Very cool. Right?
Potentially.
Another patient man.
I want to actually, we got interrupted here, and I want Justin stage right.
Jason
stage right. Sorry. I don't think we even have a Justin. No.
I'll be Justin.
You can be Justin. What do you think was successful? What do you think is working on Current on web and mobile? What's the most effective?
Well, I mean, it's hard to separate because of what we're doing, because we are, you know, we're a media company and we look into a multi-platform environment. I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, a year ago, we didn't have almost any of our videos that we made for television online because of various issues in terms of how, you know, we work with cable companies and satellite companies. Now virtually all of our, you know, all of our videos are online. And, you know, and obviously that's very powerful and interesting for us because they are things that we think are great. A lot of them, you know, started online, went to TV and exist in both places. Some of them were made specifically for TV and now have made their way back online. But I think in general, it's good content first and foremost. It's things that generate, you know, passionate dialogue. So even if it's not the best content, you know, when we do things on the Israeli and Palestinian conflict or the war in Lebanon and Israel, lots of commentary about that. People have very strong feelings on both sides, and it makes for very interesting, you know, very interesting reading and very interesting interaction. And again, just to be clear, I mean, everybody, there's this kind of classic pyramid everybody always kind of talks about as 1% of the people actually, you know, do things, 10% are kind of like contributing to things, and 89% of people just read or are passive. And, you know, that always works. Not everybody, you're never going to be able to get into a situation where everybody is going to be, you know, participating all the time. But, you know, but that's another thing that's really worked well, I think, on Current. And then thirdly, it's just, you know, working within the greater world of the web. You know, it's like things, you know, go viral and kind of develop a life of their own. So whether it's, airing, a concert, we had exclusive rights on TV, and we also had, you know, rights on the web to air a Radiohead, you know, exclusive Radiohead thing. I mean, that obviously you have a huge fan base out there and it gets picked up. Or, you know, vice versa, we're, you know, something that we happen to be featured, you know, gets put on Reddit and all of a sudden, you know, kind of bounces back and forth, and that it goes all the way back up on our site and elsewhere. So it's kind of a virtuous circle in a way. But, you know, basically at the end of the day, it's about good content that people are interested in one way, shape, or form. Like you said, it doesn't have to be one thing. It doesn't have to be a linear television product, but it's good content.
Cool. I actually, I'm going to switch gears just a little bit here, But one of the panelists who couldn't make it was a guy named RJ Cutler. I don't know if any of you know him. He did a documentary called The War Room. Mm-hmm. And recently, about a year ago, he did something called Facebook Diaries. I think it was announced literally just about a year ago. It was a multi-million dollar investment by both Facebook and Comcast to create content for VOD and the web. And so what they did was they gave cameras to people who created their content, and then they edited it into 30-minute segments that were posted on Facebook and then were put out on Comcast VOD. So it was definitely across the multi-platforms. You probably haven't heard too much about it. I definitely don't think it was a big hit. But some of the reasons that RJ said, and I'm sure he could have gone on at length, but he said, in the middle of this, after they had greenlit it for $4 million, he got a call from the Facebook people who said, you know what? We decided we're not a media company anymore. So basically, we don't really care about your making content on Facebook, which was sort of a, you know, not normally what happens when you're creating $4 million of content is they just say, well, we really don't do content anymore. In addition to that, you know, what they were doing was basically video vlogging. And he said, you know, while that was really cool a year ago, well, kind of everybody does it.
Right.
So he said, like, you know, as they were making this thing, something went from being something sort of cutting edge to sort of being like, yeah, what's the big deal? you know, the dog year syndrome. And then the third thing that he mentioned, which I thought was also very key, was that he said that the people at Comcast and the people at Facebook, and of course him, basically they didn't speak the same language at all. Like basically Facebook and Comcast could not have a conversation. That if Comcast needed to say something to Facebook, you've worked with these guys, then they basically had to call up him and say, can you please explain to them this is the way it works? So I just want to note that, you know, besides, you know, what we want and the other disconnects, there's other barriers or things that lead you to the content that you actually get right now. I want to have our panelists ask you guys some questions, but I see all these patient people. So I definitely, let me get some questions. I got one person right here. So,
back to Jason number one. I'm just curious about the sort of the economic model that you have at Current TV. Obviously, you know, particularly in your online platform, you break down into some pretty small audiences. Mm-hmm. And so from an original programming standpoint, what's your formula cost-wise on original programming for the online platform? And then when you do third-party arrangements, what kind of revenue sharing or if that's your model or if there's another model, I'd be curious about that.
It's an interesting question. I mean, again, one of the reasons that, you know, we, you know, my ultimate boss, Al, of course, invented the internet, as you all know. So the thing is, we of course thought, hey, you know, maybe we should start an internet company first and foremost. But, you know, the reality is there's a reason why Current decided to go into television and put kind of its eggs in that basket first, although we always considered ourselves a, you know, cross-media platform, which is that there is a definitive revenue model that is understood in the television market still today. So advertisers understand it. Advertisers understand, you know, online advertising more than they did certainly 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, but it's still relatively, you know, kind of small, outside of the search business, of course. And certainly in the video business, it's kind of an emerging thing. And you know, there's no distribution fees because you're not paying in the same way that you are Comcast or DirecTV to be able to support, you know, what you're doing. So online creation of content online, specifically for online, is a difficult nut to crack still. And so most of the content that we create is created specifically for TV and the web, and, you know, and it has to make sense on both platforms. What we do is, again, we try to utilize the unique properties of what the web has to be able to create a different experience than just what you're going to see in a linear television platform 24/7. But, you know, so we utilize the interactivity of it. We utilize the ability to kind of create a world around content, and for people to be able to bring in content and items and stories to talk about, to be able to figure out when we're, programming something on TV around the Jam Awards, which celebrates Jam Master Jay and kind of social, social consciousness and hip hop, we'll have Chuck D, we'll have other people in to kind of, do things, via webcam, via viewpoints, to be able to raise questions that we try to get other people engaged in the conversation. So that's the way that we try to utilize web and content originally produced for the web to be able to make it a unique experience. But in terms of just creating linear video that we're putting out there, we'd be hard. We don't have to face that problem necessarily because we have a television network, but it is a hard question. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of examples yet, and I think we're going to get there eventually, but there hasn't been a lot of examples yet of people who have been wildly successful in being able to monetize, video content, just specifically for the web platform. So, so that's...
That said, you guys from the very beginning did pay people
whose
content was selected from the VC2s to go online.
That's correct. And we're able to do that because we have a business model based around television, right? So the thing is, if I didn't have that, then it would be much more difficult for me to pay people because I wouldn't know where my revenues are coming from. But now I know what my business model is. So we always pay, pretty much for all the content we put on air, we pay because we know how that model works. Online, it's still emerging. I mean, YouTube and Google are trying to figure it out. Rever was trying to figure it out. Right.
They got bought.
Yeah.
They're still there.
Yeah, exactly. So I know. It was trying. As I didn't say, I guess they're still trying to figure it. Crackle and Sony. All these guys are trying to figure out exactly what to do. And I think, there's no question that, web-based advertising and certainly web-based video advertising is a very fast-growing segment and will continue to take off in the future. But we're not quite there yet, and nobody's quite figured out the right model. So it's very hard to say we're going to invest boatloads of cash in creating video specifically for the web because there's not necessarily a way that you're kind of guaranteed to be able to monetize it today. So that's why what we do is, we're able to leverage and utilize our television platform to be able to create content that plays very well in both categories. And by the way, because what Current is really a, kind of the nexus between news and entertainment, a lot of our content is short form anyway, just in the way that a lot of news segments are short form anyway. So it plays very well on other platforms. But, the content we are creating specifically for the web tends to evolve around what the web is good at, which is, being interactive as opposed to just creating a more expensive linear video product that can be played on the web.
I would note, and it's sort of up here, this is one of my projects, TurboNick.com, which is Nickelodeon. They stream 60 million clips a month. Viacom does $1 billion worth of business a year streaming their media, ad-supported and sponsored, making $100 million a year profit. Now, of course, I don't think they pay for their content, which definitely helps you with the bottom line. But people are beginning to turn this into a business, and the cost of actually putting it out there and putting it up there and getting, sponsorship and advertisers, there's a lot of people working in just web-based advertising with a lot of money coming in. And these big companies like Viacom are more focused on that billion than the other 30 billion, which is slowly shrinking every year. Are there more questions? Sure.
So with iSpot, we had some very successful, mashup contest with bands specifically, and one of the dirty little secrets a couple of years ago was you started doing these mashup contests, and there were several companies doing it, us, Jump Cut, now Kaltura, various people, Adobe Remix, but you'd only get 40 or 50 entrants into a certain contest or challenge. So the first one I had that was really quite successful was, this band 3 Days Grace. And we had, 700 videos made for this band. And it was interesting to me because not only 700 videos were made, but 100 of them were pretty good and 50 of them were really good. And the top five that the band eventually chose from the 25 we winnowed it down to were all made by women. And they were very different, you know, like one was sort of a fan piece. One was political, taking shots of Iraq and putting it with this song. So I would have told you then that women were more, I would have given you the standard line that's been around for 100 years, that women are more likely to engage and interact with content. I mean, that's supposedly the reason, you know, women were the first film editors. They took people from the sewing workshops and made them film editors. A little bit of arcane knowledge. But since then, I've done other things with, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins or somebody else with a lot of fans, and it's been more men. So I don't have any evidence either way.
I think Forrester just did a big, there's some beautiful infographic about this, and I think it's definitely age specific. So, you know, certain ages,
teenagers.
Are, right? I mean, certain ages are more likely to interact than, you know, et cetera. But I don't think that there's like a, I think the gender split was pretty minimal.
All right. Does my panelists, anyone have a question for the audience? Jason, stage right.
Let me think about it.
David?
I want to know what this woman back here would like to know.
Okay.
Because she's like,
what would you like to know?
She's like Arnold Horseshack back there. Yeah.
Quick cans. How many have used it or know what it is?
Yeah.
Jason? Oh,
Hank. Oh, I don't think that they allow downloads to mobile for any of the Viacom stuff. All right, Kaltura?
Well, Kaltura came out as a late competitor of iSpots, and I think they're doing a great job. It's Kaltura, for those of you who don't know, is a video editing platform, but it's based around the idea of groups working together. So you join a Kaltura, and you know everybody can add their part of it, and they do have tools that allow you to use it. I don't know how the uptake on it has been, because I haven't been paying as much attention for the last 3 months, but I think that they started out at least, you know, really in the right direction, and I'm glad you guys are doing something with them. What was the other question? Yeah, you know, we allowed downloads from almost the time we launched, and really it was only about 1% of people who pushed stuff back to their mobile phone. Now, I could see how that might be different for some, like if, you know, it was quote premium content from TurboNick, where, you know, you could get the funny little bit, you might be more likely to send it to your friend's mobile phone than a 30 second or a 1 minute video that you made.
So there's a website that Nokia has created called mosh.nokia.com, which is like a social content sharing network. And I believe right there on the front of the homepage, it shows the number of downloads, and I think it's in the billions now. And it's only been online for downloads to mobile devices. And it's only been online for, I don't know, 6 months or something like that. I don't have access. I used to. This was some work that I did a while back, was the design of this thing. But I don't have access to the metrics anymore. But I know that they pretty quickly shifted to the point where they. Something like 70% of the content uploaded was from a mobile device, but that's a very different kind of experience, because it was a community that was seeded by mobile developers, that was seeded by people that are mobile consumers, and the bulk of the people that are doing mobile downloads and uploads are in Russia and India. So these are people that don't have access to computers, and so their telephone is their access to the internet.
Right. No, I think that, yeah, especially it depends on the call to action and for the kind of stuff that I imagine that Witness would want to be doing. Right. So, you know, just imagine you're in Burma or Myanmar, as the government might be calling it that year. And you want people to be able to tell their story. Right. I would think you'd get very high engagement through mobile. Now, if it weren't blocked by some sort of government firewall,
or by the mobile provider, or, you know, I mean, there's so many barriers to getting content onto your mobile phone and putting content from your mobile phone onto the wireless web, right?
Okay, so, we're sort of wrapping up here. Sorry. So, Jason, any last question or any last comments?
I guess the only thing I would ask you guys to think about is that I know, you know, we all had these preconceptions about what content had to be successful on the mobile phone and on the internet. You know, and everybody thought YouTube, and it's got to be close-ups, and it's got to be 3 minutes long, and, you know, it's got to be about somebody getting punched in the nuts. And so I just want you guys to think about, like, you know.
And it does.
is that something that's changing? And if so, how? And, you know, I think this is a much longer, like, discussion that we're all going to have over the next, I don't know, 20 years or so. So,
any pithy responses? Okay. David? Any last comments? Jason?
I mean, to me, I would just say, again, it comes down to, is it compelling? That's really what it's all about. It doesn't matter if it's filmed on a mobile phone or in HD. It doesn't really matter if it's on your web or your phone or TV or a big screen. The question is it compelling? And compelling means different things to different people, which is a good thing, you know, as you were talking about. So it's not one single thing is compelling. But fundamentally, you're going to want to engage, interact, watch, you know, whatever, this piece of content. And that's the key thing. And that's not changing. It's just that we have a lot more tools to be able to bring to, and a lot more people that can afford now to make compelling things or potentially compelling things. And we have a lot of different opportunities to distribute it as opposed to a small clique of a few people that can decide what gets seen and what doesn't. And that's what's interesting.
Well, I have one final question. I don't know if any of you out there are filmmakers or interested in making, you know, narrative content, but who has an opinion on where narrative content's going now that we have the web and other devices? I see a hand back there that's been up for a while. So, well, I mean, I really think it's wide open at this point. I mean, we've seen little bursts like Lonely Girl and, you know, viral videos and all sorts of stuff. But I'm not sure how it's going to evolve. I mean, storytelling's been pretty much the same for a couple of thousand, many thousands of years. And there is a myth, from my point of view, there is a mythic structure to it. I do think it's adaptable. Do we have time for any more comments here?
Actually, can I say one thing?
Okay, we got one more.
So the project that I'm working on right now is exploring exactly that. Like, so the way that we tell stories has changed, and the you know, the people that are allowed to tell stories has changed, but stories really haven't changed very much. So if you want to find out more, come to my next panel on Tuesday between 5 and 6, or go to tagfilm.com. Sorry, I got to.
Thank you all.